This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Bill Timaeus by phone. Bill, can you hear me all right?
Yes. Thank you, Steve.
We'll be discussing a project he's involved with that's an interfaith project. Bill, tell us how you got interested in this.
Well, I had done a series of articles in the Kansas City Star, the newspaper for which I've worked for several decades, called Conversations with Clergy, in which I would do a Q&A with various and sundry members of the clergy of different faiths. And after doing a particular rabbi that we did an interview with, he then took a trip to Poland, where his roots all were, although he was born in Brazil, and came back and he called me and said, "Hey, I want to do a book about Jews in Poland who survived the Holocaust with Christian help, and I need somebody to help me. Are you interested?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm interested. The subject has always interested me, but I don't know how I'm going to have time until I retire." So that's actually what I've done. I retired last year, although I keep writing a weekly column on a freelance basis. But it was at Rabbi Jacques Kukierkorn is his name, and it was at his suggestion that we start to take a look at this subject.
How far along on the project are you?
Well, we're moving along quite well. We actually have a deadline of June 08, but we have done six or eight chapters on survivors so far. We have other interviews that we've done that I have not yet had time to do the writing on. We just got back from a long trip to New York. When I say long, I mean for us 4 or 5 days, in which we did 11 different interviews, I think. And we leave tomorrow morning for Chicago to do several interviews. But I'm hoping we'll have this book pretty well in hand by before the middle of next year, and published by the middle or late 08. But the book will contain not just stories of survivors and not just stories of those people who helped them survive, but to set the context for what happened to these people in Poland. I'm also writing a long chapter that will describe the long and shameful and lamentable history of anti-Judaism and Christian history that helped to create modern anti-Semitism, without which the Holocaust or Shoah never could have occurred. And I think that will help readers understand a little more clearly the atmosphere that was in play when the Holocaust was happening.
I know from previous conversations with you on this radio program and other places that you yourself are from the Christian tradition.
Right.
And yet you're saying that Christian anti-Jewish history is something that needs to be remembered.
Oh, absolutely. And my concern is that many Christians don't seem to have a clue that this is part of our own faith's history. I'm an elder in a Presbyterian church, and I've given talks about what's been going on historically, how this developed century after century after century, from really the very beginning, this ancient charge of deicide, that the Jews killed Christ, and all of that kind of stuff, and the church's complicity in the way that Jews have been treated all over these last 2,000 years is really a remarkable story that just makes you weep. In fact, I'm reading a new book about that subject by a guy named Robert Michael called Holy Hatred, which if readers are looking for a pretty concise history of what I'm talking about, that's an excellent resource. But somehow for Christians to understand that, although I was born at the end of World War II, and so I wasn't responsible for the Holocaust, and yet people who profess the faith that I profess for many, many years have helped to create the atmosphere, the anti-Semitic atmosphere that in which the Holocaust could happen. And I think we need to understand that history and acknowledge it, and if not repent of it, at least promise to do better in the future. I think that's incumbent upon those of us who are Christian.
I want to get back to that topic later in the program, but I want to focus for a few minutes on what you and the rabbi who's co-writing this with you and doing the research with you have discovered about, in Poland, how Christians were helpful to enable some of the Jews there to survive the Holocaust.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that Poland was, first of all, the country in which there were more Jews than any other country in Europe at the start of the war. The Jewish population of Poland was about 10% of the total country's population. Jews numbered between 3.3 and 3.5 million, and more than 90% of them died in the Holocaust. That said, we find that when you go to Yad Vashem, which is the Israeli Holocaust Memorial Authority, and it's that agency that provides the designation after certain rigorous examination of the cases, it provides the designation that someone is a Gentile is called righteous among the nations, and that means that person in a verifiable way helped Jews survive. Well, it turns out that in Poland, there are more righteous among the nations, more righteous Gentiles, so to speak, than in any other country. And as a percentage of the population and the percentage of Jews in the country, Poland is on a par with other countries where people help save Jews. And that's interesting for two reasons. One is that Poland has this quite well-deserved reputation for being profoundly anti-Semitic. Its own history runs hot and cold on the subject, but in the last 100 years, it has had that reputation. And the other thing is that from October 1941 on in the war, anybody caught hiding Jews in Poland was subject to death. In other countries, the penalty was not often that severe. You might be put in prison and so on. And in some countries, it seemed like everybody was hiding Jews, places like Denmark. But in Poland, you really took your life in your hands if you were somehow aiding Jews in a significant way. And yet, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of Poles did the right thing and showed moral courage and hid their neighbors who were Jewish and helped them survive the war.
Now, what variety of Christianity were the Christians in Poland who were, in this case,
entirely Catholic?
Almost all Roman Catholic.
Right. Uh-huh. They're really, you're talking Christianity in Poland and you're talking Catholicism.
And in spite of this history of anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism in Poland, as well as as many other places, including our country, America, how did some of these people overcome that prejudice, those stereotypes, and be moved to acts of such risky compassion?
Yeah, well, that's really the question, and the answer varies. In one case that we are writing about, the man who was saved had a grandmother who at one point did a great favor to a Christian woman by, in effect, helping her escape a bad domestic situation and helping her give birth in a Jewish hospital to a child and so on. And the woman felt this great debt to Grandma Tima, is her name, her first name, as we refer to her in the chapter. And when Grandma Tima's grandson, And she opened the door, and he said, "Please let me just stay for a night," as he was running hither and yon. And this woman said, "No, God has sent you to me, and you will stay here. You're not going anywhere." And she hid not only this young man, but also his uncle and three or four other people in a dugout pit under their home for 17 months, and at the risk of her own five children who lived in the house. And she did it, she said. She's gone now, but the records that we have say she did it because she felt she was paying back a favor that a Jewish woman had done to her, and she loved this Jewish woman's son and wanted to save her. There are many other stories. One story of a Kansas City woman who will be in her book is her family was in a business partnership with a Christian man, a long friendship, and it was this man who arranged for this woman and her husband and mother and several others to be hidden for 28 months under the floor of a barn.
Uh-huh.
And the man was given, the Jewish people involved here gave the Christian man money and said, "Pay the farmer every month," and that's what he did to allow them to stay there and to be fed and so on. But it was a long friendship, a business partnership, and he understood that these were fellow human beings, not first Jews or first Catholics or whatever. It was human to human, and those are the kinds of connections that somehow people step up to the plate when this happens. Now, in this case, the farmer, the farmer was being paid, and the Christian man, when they began this contract in effect to hide these Jews, put a gun to the farmer's head and said, "Look, anything happens to these Jews, and it's going to be really bad for you." And so, you know, he did it under duress, but the woman who was hidden said, "I think he was too dumb to know what trouble he would really be in if he were caught." So, lots of kind of mixed stories like that.
We're talking with Bill Timaeus, a longtime writer for the Kansas City Star newspaper, about Christians and Jews working together during the Holocaust in Poland. Bill, I want to ask you how you're finding this information and these people to interview, but let me give the phone numbers. This is a live call-in show every week on WILL, and you may call anywhere you hear the program toll-free. If it's a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates, you may call our studio by punching in 333-9455. So local calls, 333-WILL. You'll reach our technical director, Matt Kessler, and he'll put you in the line to get on the show. Happy to have comments and questions and perhaps also some sharing of information or memory that listeners may have. Bill, how are you finding these people?
A number of different ways. One was, for instance, last August I attended an international conference in Detroit area in Dearborn, Michigan, of child survivors of the Holocaust. And many of them were hidden and saved in Poland, and we've made a number of connections there. But my rabbi colleague knows... has many connections to Jewish communities all over this country and in the world, in fact. I think Jacques speaks only 8 languages or something. He's quite a remarkable guy. But we're also working with Holocaust centers around the country. We are an official project of the Midwest Center for Holocaust Education, which has created a fund to help us cover our research costs. instance, you know, the people at the Midwest Center have helped identify some subjects for us. We, a couple of weeks ago, were in New York and spent time at the Jewish Foundation for the Righteous, which is a marvelous agency that recognizes Gentiles who help Jews and financially supports those Gentiles in 27 different countries. It's currently supporting more than 1,300 Gentiles. Often,
the Gentile is a non-Jew.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Often with just $100 a month, but many of these people who are receiving this money are rural, poor Eastern Europeans, and $100 a month is a significant addition to help them cover medicines or whatever they need, and it's a way of recognizing the lives that they saved. And so the Jewish Foundation for the Righteous has helped us identify several people. And we just use our own contacts. I spent 30-plus years as a reporter, and you just start making calls and asking everybody you know, do you know anybody who fits our profile?
And if some of our listeners would say yes to that question, how may they contact you?
The easiest way is by email, which I can give you as WTAMMEUS at kc.rr.com. I can give you a number also, a phone number, which is 816-926-0366. I won't be at that number for the next 2 days, but they can certainly leave a message there.
That was 818-926.
Let me start again. 816.
816, sorry.
Yeah, 926-0366.
And the email address again
is WTAMMEUS, WTAMMEUS, at kc.rr.com. Almost an easier way to remember that is to go to my blog. I do a daily faith blog, and the way to find that is at kansascity.com. If you go on to kansascity.com, the opening page has a list of blogs, and mine is there. Just click on it, and it'll take you right to my blog, and that'll tell you how to email me.
For those with computer access, that's a good way to do it, kansascity.com, and then look for Timaeus, T-A-M-M-E-U-S. Bill, when you and the rabbi first started this, did it scare you to be going into a project that deals with so much death?
Well, yes and no. Over my career as a columnist, I often write about death from many perspectives, but particularly because I believe, as a Christian, that there's no way we can really understand the meaning of our own lives unless we begin to understand the meaning of our own death. And so, in many ways, I've written about death. I've certainly, since 9/11, when a death in my own family occurred, my sister's son, my nephew, was on the first plane to hit the World Trade Center, and I've written a fair amount about Carlton, not because my readers knew him, but rather he became for them a sort of face that they could begin to personalize what happened to 3,000 families on 9/11. And so I've done that, but it's sobering to hear the stories of what it took for people to survive. And one of the, Steve, let me say that one of the kind of terms that you often hear in this subject area is the term rescuer. And we want to acknowledge in the book that that's a problematic term in that it sounds like the Jews who were saved were very passive and did nothing to help save themselves. The reality is that although they needed Christian help to survive, without their own ingenuity and wits and resources and wisdom, they still would have perished. A good example is a man we interviewed in Houston whose help primarily was obtaining from a Christian friend about his age, about a 15-year-old, a birth certificate that said that he was born a Polish Catholic, and he faked a name, and that would not have gotten most people through the Holocaust, but this guy was clever enough and was smart enough to leverage his own assets, if you will, with that birth certificate and become almost chameleonic, change into this person, that person, work here, hide there, on his own. He hid in open, in effect, having been given the gift of this this Christian birth certificate. So the term rescuer, as I say, is one you often hear, but I think it's one that needs some clarification.
I wonder if you'll be finding any fake baptism records.
Well, almost certainly. We know of many hidden Jews who had to have fake fake ID. And when I say fake, maybe the better term is false, because there certainly were Polish citizens doing the right thing by creating false documents, but they were people often working in the very offices that produced real documents for real Polish people. And so they looked and were authentic, except that the information they contained was false. But certainly there were Jews who, in hiding, became, in effect, good Catholics. We interviewed a woman from St. Louis who did not know until 2 years after the war that she was Jewish. Her parents taught her, she was born at the start of the war, and they taught her, in effect, how to pretend to be Catholic, and she thought she was. And the first thing she did when she realized and was told by her parents that she was Jewish was she went up to her room and got a Catholic missal that she had used as a child, and she tore it up. And nowadays, now she says, "I wish I had not done that." But you know, there were people did what they had to do to survive.
And it saved her life.
Yep.
Yeah. We're talking with Bill Timaeus about a project he and a rabbi in Kansas City are working on, investigating Jews who survived the Holocaust in Poland with Christian help. And we're encouraging people who might know someone who has information about situations like that to contact the authors. The easiest way is through kansascity.com website and the faith blog that Bill writes is access there, and you can find out how to contact him. If you don't have a computer, a phone number, you can use, after the next couple days, 816-926-0366 to talk to Bill Timaeus. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. We're getting close to about halfway through the program. Let me just take a moment to say a few words about upcoming interviews we'll be having here on the air. Next week, May 6, we'll be speaking with a couple students from the University of Illinois who are involved with Amnesty International and who are involved with Students for Economic Justice, a anti-sweatshop student group. Ashley Moore and Rachel White Domain will be our guests here on Keeping the Faith next week, May 6. And let me do thank Don Nolan for filling in last week as guest host on this program when I was dealing with some family visitors. So thanks to Don for filling in so ably, I'm told, here on Keeping the Faith last week. For listeners who would like to call in and talk to our guest today with a comment or question on this project, do call us. This is a live call-in show here on WILL, a radio service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a listener-supported radio program, of course, a radio service. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, do call us at 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Keeping the Faith is support for Keeping the Faith is provided in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is in its 134th year here on this campus. We're the oldest continuous student organization on campus and the oldest charity in the county. One of our programs coming up in a week or so is the collection for Dump and Run, as university students will be leaving the campus after taking exams. Many, many thousands of them take off for the summer, and we collect things that they're throwing away that are still valuable and recycle them. So we encourage students who are listening to this program or parents of students who might be driving down to help them move to remember that if you don't have room for things in your car that still are of use to someone, do put them in the large 4-foot square cardboard boxes with the green signs all around campus, or bring them to the University YMCA, 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right across from Lincoln Hall on campus. We'll be collecting starting Monday, May 7, going through Saturday of that week, May 7 through 12, and then again the following week, May 14 through 19. And then we're going to take a break, but we'll collect again right before our big sale in the fall, the week of August 14 through the 21st, and then the sale starts August 23rd through the 25th in the Stock Pavilion at the University of Illinois. We fill the whole Stock Pavilion with interesting furniture and kitchenware and books and clothes and, well, just almost anything you can imagine, because we have new students moving in the fall, particularly international students. This campus now has 5,700 international students who come here to study, and many of them arrive with just a couple suitcases and need to furnish whole rooms or apartments. We don't accept computer monitors or sleeper sofas or large appliances, but almost anything else do bring to the Y. If you have a question, call me, Steve Shoemaker, 337-1500. Is the number at the Y. Well, let's get back to Bill Timaeus, our guest today via phone from, are you at your home or office, Bill?
As it turns out, my office is now in my home.
That's right.
So the answer is yes.
You're officially retired, but still writing a weekly column for the Star. What does it focus on?
It's in the faith section, and I focus on various aspects of religion and various religions. My column yesterday had to do with the 400th anniversary of the Episcopal Church in this country and the divisions in that denomination. And my column for next week is written from Ground Zero in New York, and some thoughts about the ripple effects of religious terrorism and religious fanaticism and so on.
Now, when you write these columns on different aspects of faith, what kind of response do you get? Are your readers, do they ever write to you? Do they email you?
Yeah. My email address is always at the bottom of my column, and it's really fascinating. I've written columns for 30 years, and I still have trouble anticipating how people will react to things. The public is a strange beast at times, and for the most part, I must say that people are very kind, and they find things about what I'm doing that they like, and sometimes have questions about, sometimes challenge me on this and that. Now and again, I get some very angry responses about things, often from people who believe that they know exactly what God thinks about X, Y, and Z, and they believe that I ought to know that as well, and believe it with as much tenacity as they believe it. But really, people are generally quite kind and find that what I'm trying to do in the column is to inform them, is to make them think. I mean, that's the job of a columnist, and I consider words sacred, even though some words are used for destructive purposes, just as I consider all ground holy, even though some ground becomes killing fields. And my job is to remind people of the sacredness of words and what how words can affect us and make us different people in many ways.
I guess I would raise the possible point that words are powerful and can be used for sacred purposes or for evil purposes.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about this idea of writing for a paper on religious faith themes. How many reporters are there at major papers now who are kind of specialists in areas of faith and religion and interfaith issues? It shows up in so many stories everywhere in the paper, on the
right.
Front page, of course.
Yeah, and really, the media generally and newspapers have really historically done a very poor job of covering faith matters. Most major newspapers assign one person to be the religion person, religion reporter, and if you can imagine the parallel here that I'm going to suggest, it, what would a newspaper, a major metropolitan newspaper, be with a one-person sports staff?
Sure.
Assigned to cover all pro sports, college sports, high school sports, all the court cases and trends and on and on. Yeah, it's ridiculous and irresponsible, and yet that's the way most newspapers cover religion. Now, it's certainly been the case, particularly since 9/11, that it's very hard to find a story in a newspaper today that does not have some thread of religion running through it. And increasingly, general assignment reporters are having to become more knowledgeable about faith matters and even understand some theology of all things to be able to cover these matters in a way that is fair and accurate. But still, most papers don't do very well at it, and the sad thing to me is that most readers don't complain about it. I think readers need to take ownership of that, and just as they complain when we change one comic strip for another, and we hear from all of them, if we don't cover something that's of interest in terms of religion, I think they also ought to complain. Or if we cover it wrong, or if we do something that is wonderful in that area, they also ought to compliment us. But and readers do some of that, but I find that editors often think that readers aren't very interested in this stuff because they really don't complain about the poor quality of religion coverage in the media.
There may be poor quality in some of the reporting, but in the newspapers, but it's far worse on television.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, now there's some places that do a pretty good job: Religion and Ethics News Weekly on PBS,
yes.
and so on. But
well, PBS is always exempt.
Okay, yeah, but really, that's right. There are lots. I mean, your local television news stations just generally don't have a clue what to do about covering religion, and so they pretty much ignore it unless there's some spectacular thing.
I've noticed that National Public Radio has vastly improved in the last 10 years in terms of its religious coverage.
Right, yeah, I agree.
Let's get back to our topic for today. We're talking with Bill Timaeus about a book he and a rabbi in Kansas City are writing in the process of researching, and I thought it was so interesting hearing about the type of research they were doing that I thought it'd be a good conversation. And let's do continue talking about what the process you're going through. You mentioned you're traveling to different cities, that you have a grant from this Midwest Center for Holocaust Research.
Well, let me clarify that. Yeah. We don't have a grant from them. What we do have is their permission to have created a fund into which tax-deductible donations can go.
I see.
And we're out finding those donations.
Okay. And you use those funds to travel to do this kind of research.
Right.
And you were talking earlier about how you find some of these people, but isn't it particularly difficult these days because of the age of the Holocaust survivors? You mentioned going to this Child Survivors of the Holocaust Conference.
Yeah. In fact, if this book doesn't get written in the next 5 years, it's going to be impossible to write it probably, because the survivors are, the youngest of the survivors are in their 70s, and we have interviewed people in their 80s, in their late 80s, and these, you know, there are just fewer and fewer of them. So what we do is sit down with them for several hours and have them tell us the story of how they survived. And we ask for, you know, any kind of accompanying of the documents, their own writings, that sort of thing. And then we put together a chapter that tells that story, and we have them check it for accuracy to make sure that, that we're not misrepresenting something.
Let me give the phone numbers here in the station again for those who'd like to call with a comment or question. 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number if it's a long-distance call to Champaign, Illinois. Otherwise, use those in Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455, and I see we do have a call on one of the local lines. Let's go to line number one. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, there's been a lot of books written lately on Orthodox Jewish people looking into evangelical Christianity. I'd like to hear your opinion on this.
Would you just say a little bit more about what the thrust of those books is?
Basically, they're just looking in the phenomenon of the evangelical Christianity being very pro-Israeli and pro-Jewish.
Right. The Judaism historically and generally is not what one would call an evangelical kind of faith. It's a faith in which the Jews tell the story of their faith, and if you feel like you're part of that story, then you're encouraged to consider joining, but they're not a group that goes out and does conversions necessarily. But to the point about the friendship that has been developed between Israel and Jews in this country and evangelical Christians, some of that friendship has come about because of the way that some branches of Christianity read Revelation. That is, they read the book of Revelation to suggest that until Jews again control the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the Second Coming cannot occur. And the Christians who read the book that way thus become quite pro-Israeli, because the Temple Mount is currently controlled by Muslims, and they want Jews to be in charge so that the Second Coming can happen. And I have some trouble with that approach to theology. I have some trouble with that kind of technical and literal reading of Revelation, which is a book that even John Calvin refused to write a commentary for because it was so difficult to understand. But I suggest to my Jewish friends that they just be careful about who their friends are, that there are motives here that may not be quite as pure as they seem. And yet, I must say, on the other hand, that there are many evangelical Christians who are legitimately and in many ways sincerely pro-Israel and have fought through this long history of Christian anti-Semitism to arrive at a position that I consider quite legitimate.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Mm-hmm. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And that includes listeners on the website, WILL.UAUC.edu. And incidentally, this program, as well as all of our other programs, are archived there. So if you missed part of this and would like to hear that, go to your computer and that website, WILL.UAUC.edu, and then check on AM and then Keeping the Faith, and you can find our programs archived there for your listening via your computer. Continue talking with Bill Timaeus, our guest, a writer for the Kansas City Star. Tell us about when you and the rabbi sit down with someone, who takes the lead? I mean, you're the professional writer, but the rabbi may have, as you say, he speaks a lot of languages, but also just being, when you're talking with a Holocaust survivor, is the Jewish connection important?
Right. Oh, it is. And it would be very difficult, in my view, for us to write this book, just one of us to write it and do the interviews. The interview process inevitably involves Yiddish words, Hebrew words, as they're spoken, the rabbi will turn to me and say, that means this, that means that. And on the other hand, what I bring to the process is a long career of interviewing and how to bring information out of people and to get it down right and be accurate and the writing itself, which I do the writing and the rabbi does the editing of it and suggestions, and so we work out a kind of way. But it's certainly the case that when we sit down, we describe, again, the project to people and say to them that this is why we need your help to hear your story, which we very much want to hear. And then we've done this enough that we've developed a kind of routine about where we start with the story and some common questions that we get at. And it's a little bit like a dance troupe that has been on stage for 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 times, and you begin to sense how to work together right. And our working relationship has really been wonderful. Jacques is a really bright guy, and we've somehow managed to find a real harmony in what we're doing here.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to local line number one.
Hello. I just wanted to respond to the statement about anti-Semitism as it went through the centuries in Europe. Mm-hmm. I have read Jewish poetry and fiction which talk about it, and it's absolutely horrifying when you read about it, or at least it was to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you, and in fact, it's one of the reasons that I've been proposing that people who are interested in this subject not only eventually read what we'll write about it in our book, but read such books as Holy Hatred that I mentioned. And there's
that author was Robert Michael.
Right, Robert Michael. And there's another one called Sources of the Holocaust by Steve Hochstadt, Hochstadt, which covers some of the same ground. And it is horrifying. It's to realize, for instance, that Martin Luther, the father of the Reformation, wrote in 1543 a little tract called on the Jews and their lies, in which he suggested burning down all the synagogues and burning the Talmud and running Jews out of town and starving them and on and on and on. I mean, it's just appalling stuff, and a lot of Christians don't understand that that's been in our own faith's history.
Thank you to the caller. Well, let's move to another caller waiting on line number 4, our toll-free line. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to share my views and get your comments on this. It's running around Europe about all these laws for prosecuting people for Holocaust denial. My personal opinion is that's about the stupidest thing you could do, because then you just drive that underground, or you're going to drive it to other countries like Iran comes to mind.
Yeah.
You know, I personally don't think the numbers matter, but...
Yeah, I have a couple of responses to that, and that's a really good question. First, I am, as a journalist, long and ardently committed to free speech and to non-censorship and so on. And so if it were up to me, I would not make Holocaust denial illegal in any country. That said, I want to do nothing if I'm in one of those countries in Europe where this is going on. I want to do nothing to encourage the foolish people who are denying the Holocaust. This is an absolutely goofy position. There is almost no event in history that has been better documented than the Holocaust. I don't want Holocaust deniers to have any serious public venue. I don't want them to, you know, be given talk shows on public radio and that sort of thing. Although that, you know, obviously that's not up to me, but I think we do have to recognize that there are still is Holocaust denial going on. We recently, as you alluded to, saw it in Iran with a big conference on that attracted Holocaust deniers from around the world. But if it were up to me, I would not make any kind of thought about that illegal. I think I agree with you that that's kind of a foolish approach.
Well, I've never talked to anybody that was a Holocaust denier, but I have talked to people that you know, believe in the Trilateral Commission and all that, and I've
black helicopters.
And I've talked to people who were you know, supporters of the Ku Klux Klan, and if you just let them talk, their silliness becomes readily apparent. I think it's much better to have that stuff out in the open, regardless of the venue. I mean,
yeah,
even if it's public radio, I don't think you have to listen to them too long before you realize the untenability of their position.
But on the other hand, let's also remember history. Let's remember that this profound anti-Semitism that we find among many Holocaust deniers was the law of the land, in effect, in Nazi Germany. I mean, the German people were swept up in this stuff, and it has profound consequences.
Fine. Well, my opinion, I mean, Hitler wanted a war, and he needed an enemy, and I guess the Jews were convenient, and there was some history there.
Well, thank
you. But if you tore through the Smithsonian and look at some of our World War II caricatures of Japanese,
yep,
you know, that's a classic theme throughout history,
yep,
is to dehumanize your enemy. So.
Well, thank you very much for raising that point. We appreciate it. Let me mention a book by one of our former guests on this program, Don Shriver, former president of Union Theological Seminary in New York, who wrote a book called Honest Patriots, Loving a Country Enough to Remember Its Misdeeds. And it's an Oxford University Press book. And when Shriver spoke here recently at the University Y, he was talking about the kind of research he did in preparation for that book of seeing what countries have like Germany have done, to very effectively remember the anti-Semitism, the horrible anti-Semitism that led to the Holocaust there, and the kind of memorials that the government has put up to remind their own citizenry, their own current government, of that history.
That's right.
We have another caller waiting. I want to move quickly to line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. I'm actually a regular reader of Bill's blog, and Bill, I want to thank you for everything that you do there.
Thank you.
I have a specific question about, in your studies, anti-Semitism seems to be a pretty broad word and kind of nebulous and hard to wrap, it's hard for me to wrap my head around, but I was particularly wondering about, anti-Semitism in Europe would have had a very sort of Catholic background, whereas anti-Semitism in America would be by and large a Protestant phenomenon.
Yes.
And I was kind of wondering about how, whereas I would imagine that a Catholic in Poland, let's say in the 1600s, has a very deep historical, there's a his history there, a common narrative, whereas, say, the Ku Klux Klan, they don't really have that kind of history, but it's kind of sprung out of nowhere. And I was kind of wondering on the origins of, can you separate the origins? And if you could flesh that out for me, I'd really appreciate it.
My reading, that's a good question, and it's a difficult question, but my reading is that when the Protestant Reformation occurred in the 16th century, that the Protestant churches that began to emerge from that brought with them the anti-Jewish attitudes that had been embedded in the Catholic Church. That was not the issue. That is, the Protestants, the people who became the Protestants and the Catholics, really kind of agreed that Jews were Christ killers and evil people and ought to be run out of town and so on. And so when the Protestant Reformation occurred and Protestants came to the U.S., what became the U.S. to settle here, they brought a lot of that trash with them.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that there was ever any just Catholic approach to it or just Protestant approach to it.
I think part of the history in this country, at least in the Midwest that I know best, although partly the South, I think, well, certainly the South too, that it became such a Protestant, it was so thoroughly and completely Protestant for so long that that what Jews there were so few,
yeah,
that they were hardly noticed. And then when more started emigrating, it was like when Catholics started emigrating to this country, the Protestants had this hegemony for so long that here were foreigners. Here was something strange, and there were all those very human fears and prejudices that immediately started showing up in some very horrible ways.
It was fear of the other, yeah, in many ways, yeah.
Did you want to follow up any more, caller?
I'm a little suspect of finding a sort of a common thread. I understand a Lutheran in Northern Germany at the time of the Reformation would certainly have a sort of a Catholic sensibility about these things. But when I look at, and that my knowledge is rather limited, but even in sort of film and popular commentary about groups that were, especially in the South, it seems that the anti-Semitism that emerged there was much more jingoistic, and it was almost the fear of the other. It had in its essence a religious identity to it. Whereas when I read about anti-Semitism, and I haven't read a lot in the old country, as they say, it seemed that a lot of it was political. I don't see as much of a religious background to it. Although it's there, there's a huge political history. And here in America, I just didn't think it was there. And so I think the fear of the other may be here a little bit more than it was there. But Of course, I don't know, and I'd like to know what Bill thinks about that. So
there are really two aspects of anti-Semitism, I think, if we break it down. One is theological. It has to do with Jews as deicide. The other is racial. It began, Jews filled the role of moneylenders because Christians were not allowed to do that job, and therefore Jews became accused of being usurious, and the role of Jews started to change economically, and so people began to assign to them, derogatory characteristics like greediness and that sort of thing. And so,
and Muslims were not allowed to charge interest either.
Right. Yeah. And so I just think you have to be a little bit careful about separating a theological anti-Judaism from racial and political anti-Semitism, and that separation is really hard at times.
Yeah. Would you say there's anything particularly, could you point to something that is uniquely American and when it comes to anti-Semitism? Is there something that only Americans do that is particularly anti-Semitic that just kind of the rest of the world just kind of passed by on that one?
I'm not sure that I could. And in fact, in modern America today, I was at a conference at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum a year or so ago, at which a rabbi said that for most Jews in America today, anti-Semitism is not part of their daily experience. And so we've come to a much better place in this country than we ever were. But I suppose if there were anything peculiarly American about this subject, it might be economic, or a sense of separateness. Keep Jews out of our neighborhoods. Keep them out of our country clubs. That sort of stuff.
All right. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you very much for the call. Someone who reads the blog that Bill writes that's available at kansascity.com and then looking under the faith section. Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Bill Timaeus, a columnist for the Kansas City Star, even though after several decades now he's officially retired. He's working on the project with a rabbi in Kansas City investigating Jews in Poland, where Jews were about 10% of the population, he was telling us, before the war, Second World War. Jews in Poland who survived the Holocaust with Christian help. Bill, I'd like to get you to agree maybe to talk with us in about a year on this project, and I don't even have time to hear your answer, but I'll be hoping you can do that. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Remember the good old days? No? Well, that's either because you haven't lived them yet, or you need to check the note you left on the bedside table. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're looking at age and memory with a Nobel Prize winner searching through the mechanics of the brain. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Muhammad; Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; Busey Bank; Colonial Pantry, Champaign; and Spectrum Consulting, Mattoon. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.